I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. For the past 46 years, people in Cuba have lived a life far apart from their Caribbean and American neighbors. Ever since Castro seized control in 1959, Cubans have followed Fidel, sometimes willingly, enthusiastically, sometimes with great reluctance. A new documentary film presents a retrospective view of the best and the worst of Fidel Castro.
New York's Pennsylvania station rarely has seen anything like it. Only the magnetism of a Castro could produce it.
Well, I'm very glad to be here again because I fulfilled my promise of coming after the victorious revolution.
Just 30 days ago, Fidel Castro entered Havana to be greeted by cheering mobs as one of the greatest heroes in Cuba's history.
You have many communists in your government, is that so?
I know. Because
we are neighbors, and in one way or another, we ought to be to live in peace, United States and Cuba.
This is a subject that is close to the heart of the filmmaker, Adriana Bosch. She was born and raised in Cuba. Her parents were among those who first embraced the leader and later left in despair. Her family's experience is one that quite accurately reflects the ambivalence of Cubans and the contradictions of Castro. Is it today possible to take the measure of Fidel Castro? Has he failed his people in his passion for socialism and his opposition to the United States? Or did he accomplish something simply by standing up to America? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. The filmmaker, Adriana Bosch, joins me in our Boston studio. Her new documentary, Fidel Castro, airs at the end of this month on PBS's American Experience. You can look for the local listings where you are, Adriana. It's nice to have you here.
Good morning. Nice to be here as well.
Congratulations on the film. I was.
Thank you.
It does something which I'd not had before, and that it sort of ties together a little bit of Castro and Cuba and America and the rest of the world in a way that we don't often see it pulled together. Was that part of what you intended to do?
Yes. I mean, we were doing a biography of Castro pretty much in the tradition of the American Experience's greatest and acclaimed biographies. And these biographies require a context in which you see the actor play out. Fidel is a man who led Cuba, who also challenged the United States, who then projected his power everywhere in the world. So as you began to follow him, you had to tie all these things together if you were to understand him and his place in history. So it was necessary to take all these things and brought them into focus.
Now, I have friends, journalists, who have worked in Latin America over the past 20 years, and some of them have tried and succeeded in getting interviews with Fidel Castro. The one thing that he says is, I will not speak English. I'm going to do these interviews in Spanish. And yet you have a fair amount of English language, Fidel Castro. I guess, would this be at a time before he had, you know, made this decision?
I think Fidel is reluctant to speak English because he's reluctant to make mistakes. And also there might be a nationalist kind of bend into trying to do that. He has a very cute thing he does. He's always very aware of his audiences and how he's reaching out to them. Fidel Castro's charisma is, of course, one of his greatest weapons. And there's a little thing he does even when he speaks in English. There is always a word that he doesn't remember, that he doesn't know how to pronounce. And he always turns to the next person and says, you know, we are vecinos. ¿Cómo se dice vecinos? Oh, neighbors. And you see that over and over in the clips, and that endears you to him. I think probably his English fell out of practice. And as his interviews got heavier and heavier, and he had to be more defensive about his policies and explain them, he probably took refuge in the language that he dominates, which is Spanish. He is eloquent in Spanish.
You know, we now pretty well universally use the term dictator when we talk about him. The human rights abuses of his time are always in the first paragraph of any story about Castro's Cuba. I want to go back to one of those English language clips that your archivist was able to dig up. This is Fidel Castro in that first year of the revolution, talking about his obligations. Let's listen to that.
My obligation with the people, what I have to do now and in the future, is that what be good for my country. And if for my country it is necessary that I
renounce to any position. I would gladly renounce to any position because sincerely, I don't ambition power, money, nothing, only to serve my country.
Good.
That's from a new documentary called Fidel Castro by Adriana Bosch, who was here with me in the studio. And I suspect that if Fidel Castro was here with us in the studio, he'd listen to that and say, so, I'm doing that. I'm, you know, I don't look for money. I don't look for power. I simply want to serve my country. I suspect he sees himself as still doing that today, 46 years later.
If you look at the end of the documentary, there is a clip by him, I believe is maybe a year old, a little more than that, where he says, only now I realize that my destiny was not to rest at the end of my years. So this theme of being a servant of the Cuban people and being in power only because the Cuban people need him is a recurring theme that he has never abandoned. I think for a lot of people who have observed Fidel, it is clear that no, money was never an objective in of itself. If he ever needed money, if he ever went into international transactions of a shady nature, it wasn't truly to enrich himself, but to have the money to do what he wanted to do. Now, what does Fidel want to do? There is a meeting between Castro and a friend in 1946 when he goes into the University of Havana in and his friend asks him, Fidel, Guajiro is what he called him because that's what they used to call him, Hick. What do you want to do when you're, what do you want out of life? And Fidel answers, I want glory and fame, la gloria, la fama. So there is no doubt, I think, in anyone's mind that Fidel is a man of great ambition, great political ambition, obsessed by politics, obsessed by the pursuit of power, obsessed by his own dreams. This is a man filled with dreams and dreams of grandeur, of heroism. He dreams heroic dreams for Cuba. He dreams that Cuba is a world power, and he does achieve for himself and for Cuba a position that the word I use is inordinate for the size and the importance of Cuba in the world. And he achieved this by his relationship with the Soviet Union and by the force of his personality. But there is no doubt that he always, you know, power was one of its objectives and glory was one of his objectives.
Now, I know you've done documentary films about American presidents, and I also know that this particular story is one that is closer to you and to your family. In fact, one piece of archival footage which is missing from the film would be that your first encounter with Fidel Castro himself. Do you want to tell us about that?
Well, you know, when I came of age, I was, you know, when I was 4 years old, Fidel walks into Havana, and I was caught in that incredible national upheaval.
At four? You remember this?
Oh, of course. I remember it as if it were today. Everyone does. This is a memory, I think, that if you speak to any Cuban, is indelible. It's the one memory of my childhood that is had stayed with me. I would go to the TV and kiss the TV. Of course, his entry into Havana and his journey from Santiago de Cuba to Havana was televised. This is a revolution televised. And I remember kissing the screen and, you know, imposing on my dad to take me to the airport when he got back to Santiago in February 1959 and begging him. And he took me to Santiago. So my father's got me in his arms, and Fidel comes down the ladder. He picks me up. He kisses me, and he says, what a little girl. What a pretty little girl. I'm editing. He actually said, what a pretty little fat girl. And, you know, sometimes I wonder if I have held a grudge since. But no doubt you were part of this. This was, you know, the hopes of the Cuban people were just exuberant, and I think, in a way, they had a lot to do with the building of Fidel's own sense of himself and his importance. All of a sudden, he was a messiah. Everyone looked at him and upon him to solve all of the problems of the nation. He was acclaimed in a way that only heroes were acclaimed in World War II.
Now, your parents were caught up in this at the time.
Absolutely.
They were big fans. When you talk to them about it, do they look back at that now as as the people making a mistake, pushing all their wishes onto one man, or was Castro himself smart enough to actually have constructed this messianic personality?
Well, you know, no, there is a messianic political culture. Cuba has a messianic political culture. The word revolutionary in the Cuban, you know, in the Cuban mind and in the Cuban soul, national soul, always meant something very special. Revolutionaries were good people. Revolutionaries were the ones that were going to deliver an island that had always had political problems, that had political problems of corruption. Bad government was really what Cuba suffered from most of its history as a republic. And so a lot of people deposited their hopes on Fidel. You also have to understand that Fidel became the symbol of a rebellion against Batista. And Batista was a hated dictator. By the time Fidel comes to power in 1959, there is hardly anyone in Cuba who supports Batista. So all this sentiment gets poured onto Fidel. And as he arrives in Havana, there is a description by a journalist who was there who says he was like Moses parting the Red Seas. The crowd just parted to let him pass. And it's a remarkable moment.
It was also 46 years ago. Fidel Castro remains in power in Cuba. It is one of the longest tenures of any leader, not just in the West, but in the Eastern world. And his life and his connection with Cuba is detailed in a new documentary by Adriana Bosch. She's here with me in the studio. When we come back after the break, we'll talk more about her own family relations with that particular story, but also about the man and how his story has become so much a part of Cuba's story. We'd like to have you join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour, we're talking with Adriana Bosch. Her new film is called Fidel Castro, and it tells the story of the remarkable story of this man's time, his arrival to power, and his decades trying to promise a better life to people in Cuba. Adriana and her own family have their own love and despair relationship with Castro. We'll talk a little bit further about that as well. We'd like to have you join us. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to take a call from Tampa, Florida, and Ara is joining us on the line. Hi, Ara.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am a Puerto Rican, and I wasn't born there, but I lived there on and off, and I went to high school there. And I really have, I know this is weird, but some sense of... I wish that Puerto Rico would have, or would have now, or before, somebody that would stand up for Puerto Rico's independence or right to be independent, or a voice, because I feel like having Puerto Rico having been a part of the United States for over 100 years, and I don't feel at all... I don't feel like Puerto Rico has any self-respect as a country, as a people. I don't feel that we have that. I feel that our culture is a dying culture, and it's the Puerto Rican culture, and it's because of that state of limbo that we've been in for over 100 years. And I really don't feel, this is kind of weird that I'm admitting this, but I don't feel any pride in that.
Let me begin by saying, and I don't mean to question your own vision of your own country, that Puerto Rico has a very live culture today. I was in Puerto Rico in preparation of this film, and what shocked me about Puerto Rico is how the youth culture is so so strong and so vital. So I think that perhaps in reaction to that loss of nationality, a very interesting culture is coming of age in Puerto Rico. Now, Fidel did awaken Cuban nationalism. There is no doubt about that. And I think he touched a button in the hearts of Cubans that, in a way, brought to life the memories of the American presence in the island in the early 20th century. The costs have been tremendous. Perhaps there is another way. Perhaps that there is an a less radical, a less confrontational way in which the nationality of Puerto Rico can be asserted, and Puerto Rico can find too its place in the sun.
Let me just ask, Ara, when if we were to have this conversation in Puerto Rico, would there be people saying that they admire the Cubans, or that they admire Castro, or that they wish they had someone with the sort of spine that he has?
Well, I don't really think so, but because it's a weird admiration, if you will. It's just I feel like we have been sold off, like we were sold off.
Let me just jump in. Is it an admiration for Castro, not for what he's done necessarily on a day-to-day basis in Cuba, but as a symbol of resistance to the United States in Latin America?
Yes, exactly. That's what I feel. Absolutely. Yeah.
But you know, there's a part of Ara. Thank you for your call. There's that difficulty that Ara has articulating this. You know, that it's not black and white. That it's not an easy thing to express. The contradictions that this man introduced, carried with him, they actually go back to that very first year. You were saying earlier that he swept in as the hero who was going to rescue Cuba from Batista. Batista, at that time, and it's quite graphically shown in the film, was in the habit of shooting resistors and making sure that their bodies lay around so everybody could see them.
But absolutely, yeah. It was his way. He thought in this way he would instill fear in the population. What he did was instill revulsion.
And the interesting thing is that in the days afterwards, Castro and his revolutionaries go around shooting, executing Batistas. He's roundly criticized by this of bringing his own bloodbath to Cuba. And he answers this in one of his classic or characteristic speeches. We're going to hear just a snippet of that.
When the young people would appear murdered in the streets with the tops of their heads, when the yard of the barracks would be full of cadavers, when our women were violated, when the children were murdered, when the police force would go into the embassy to assassinate our people, no one made a campaign against Cuba.
And that, to me, if I think back on the way that you're telling the story, Adriana, is the first contradiction that we see in Castro, because he had the people with him. They were, yeah, you're right, let's take these people.
90% of Cubans were in favor of those executions, which is a very little known fact. I find that moment very revealing, because I think it's not only that contradiction in the humanitarian, in a sense, objectives of the revolution, but it is also the first time that you see Fidel reacting strongly in public to the United States. I think that he's deeply offended by the notion that the United States does not understand why he's doing this and how much he is representing the will of the Cuban people in doing this. He has earlier, as early as June 1958, he has written a letter to Celia Sanchez, his friend and confidant, where he says that fighting the United States is his destiny. I believe this will be my destiny. However, that is a private letter. This is, I think, the first instance where you see Fidel truly angry at the United States and thinking that the United States completely misunderstands Cuba. And I think he begins to feel a little paranoid that there is a campaign mounted in the United States against them for no reason at all. There's something ugly about what happens in Cuba at this point, and I think, however justified these executions might have been, by involving the people in these executions, I think Cubans, in a way, become callous to the notion
of... What was the word?
Paredón.
Paredón, to
paredón,
the wall?
Paredón, paredón. That word enters the Cuban vocabulary, and it becomes very easy for people to ask for paredón, first against the Batistianos who were guilty, then against the Batistianos who might have been less guilty, and subsequently against people who simply opposed the revolution.
To the wall.
To the wall. Paredón. I mean, it's executing somebody against the
wall.
Can
I ask you, though, your family left in 1968, am I right?
In 1968, yes.
So that's just 9 years.
Yes.
That your parents go from these great fans of Fidel to so disgusted or so in despair of what's become of the country that they're leaving.
Well, actually, it was much earlier than that. I think my family was, you know, turned against Fidel Castro very early on, I believe. I don't know. I can't pinpoint a date. But I think that by the fall of 1959, it was clear to a lot of Cubans that what was on the cards was a dictatorship, that Fidel was beginning to amass power, that there was no room for opposition.
He brought in this coalition government, but they were kind of, they didn't do anything. He was still the only man who made decisions.
The Uber Matos case, when Uber Matos is sentenced to 20 years in prison and accused of treason, and most people understand that there was no reason for that, I think was a pivotal case, and the breakdown of the coalition. And you begin to hear of that dreaded word in Cuba at the time, comunismo. I mean, there was like an ugly word, comunismo. And for people like my parents, that was very influential, very determinant. Also, you began to see a steady attack on private property, beginning with the agrarian reform law of May 1959, and the way in which it was applied. There was a certain arbitrariness in the application of the reform law, and it was progressive. You saw that first it was the huge land holdings, and everybody said, okay, a lot of the land, these lands are idle. There had been support for land reform in Cuba for quite a while. But then they began to reach deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, and people felt threatened.
I want to go back to our callers. We've got David joining us on the line from San Francisco. Hi, David.
Good morning, folks. Hey, I'm 67, so I can remember. I was in Minneapolis, Minnesota, at the University of Minnesota then, when Fidel rolled in. I can remember the excitement we had. It really, looking back now, this was the seeds of the new left in America that later led to the anti-war movement, a new spirit, a new kind of bohemian spirit that came along with the left. And it was not only Fidel, but also, you mentioned Celia Sanchez, Camila Cienfuegos, who disappeared mysteriously a year early. Camila Cienfuegos, who was definitely a romantic hero.
Was Che Guevara part of those who was admired?
Che, certainly. Armando Hart, the minister who became the minister of education, right?
Yes.
All of these folks.
Culture.
And I think even up in Minnesota, we knew them as individuals. We felt for them as individuals. And it began a movement. I think you could kind of put some of the seeds of the hippie movement. Looking back today, you could see hippie punk rock, hip-hop of today, the spirit that you could of the youth doing the poetry of today.
David, let me ask you, in your own recollection, if there was that falling away from affection for this new government, these new revolutionaries in the way that Adriana's describing it happening in Cuba?
Well, I think it took for a lot that didn't really happen. It took a lot longer than it probably, looking back at it now, it should have. I've just been reading a book, in fact, I have it right here now, which talks about it in Cuba. Do you know what this is? She's a journalist, Alma Gorma Prieto. It's called Dancing with Cuba. She went to Cuba as a dancer.
Yes, she's a very, very well-reputed journalist.
And a really good one. And she went there as a dancer, and it was when they were putting together the new national dance. And she saw all of that during the 10 million tons, when they were supposed to have the big failure of getting 10 million tons of sugar.
David, let me, if I can, just stop you there, because there is a moment in Adriana's own story, which I find kind of interesting here, and that is, Adriana, your family leaves Cuba, goes to Spain, moves to Florida, I think. Is that right?
No, we came to Elizabeth, New Jersey, probably the darkest day of my life.
All right.
No offense.
but there's a period of time after you come to the United States when you develop this kind of, I don't know what it is, nostalgia or affection or defense of Castro, almost in opposition to your parents. Is it like teenage revolt, or was there more to it than that?
All of the above. I think that there was a bit of nostalgia. And I think there was a lot of just rebellion involved in it. Also, because of the ideas that were prevalent at the time, you began to put a value or an additional value on social justice. And this began to evoke in me earlier memories and memories of the enthusiasm that I had seen on the other side. I remember the woman who took care of me, a black Cuban, coming to the house one day.
This was in New Jersey?
No, in Cuba.
Ah, okay.
I began to remember these things a little more sharply. And coming to, exuberantly happy, she would now quit her job with us, taking care of me, and go to Havana to be with her daughter who was going to go to medical school. And this was, you know,
this is the daughter of someone who's living at a very low social level.
Yeah, I mean, this is a woman who took care of me.
Yeah.
And a servant at my house. And I remember that distinctly. I remember the truckloads. We lived in a middle-class neighborhood. But there was a cannery toward the very end of the road. And I remember the truckloads of people, of workers from the cannery, going by our nice houses and chanting and chanting and chanting as if taunting, you know, all of us middle-class people who were behind our
fences. What were they saying?
Fences.
Was it abusive or
it was revolutionary, revolutionary slogans, but you could see that they were louder and they were happier, and it was a display of now we are the ones on top here. So, and I began to look at the Cuban Revolution from a different angle. I began to listen to the narrative of the people who had gain, of the people who had nothing and now had something. And I also began to listen to the narrative of Cuban nationalism. I began to know more about Cuban history and began to reassess Castro's stands vis-a-vis the United States. Of course, this is the Vietnam War, it's the 1970s.
Did you find because you're in America at this point while you're doing this sort of re-examination, did you find from David's crowd, the American left, a kind of welcome openness to this kind of...
Oh, absolutely. We were all beginning to be part of the same thing, and I think that a lot of what was happening was that kind of group pressure. If you wanted to be cool, you know, you couldn't be a gusano. I mean, you have to embrace, at least in part, the Cuban Revolution. And I think a lot of young Cubans did, or some young Cubans did.
What did your parents have to say about this?
My parents had... It was a constant struggle. I remember the most hurtful thing my parents said to my father once said to me was, the problem is that you have no character and that everything you hear, you will believe. How could you do that? They felt it as a personal betrayal. Subsequently, of course, I matured. I began to look at, you know, the Cuban Revolution the way it really was. And I began to re-engage the other narrative. And the other set of memories began also to surface in my mind. The memories of the milicianos coming to the neighborhood and the fear that instilled in everyone. The arbitrariness of the arrests. The sense, the keen sense that you felt, or at least I felt as a teenager, of oppression in a way of looking
in the school or among your friends,
in school, in your friends, looking over your shoulder, making sure that you didn't say anything incorrect that could get you in trouble. There is an anecdote right before we were ready to leave Cuba in 1968. I wrote a composition, an essay, for my English class about what would I do if my country were invaded. And of course, I knew what I was supposed to write and went ahead and wrote it. And the teacher lauded it all over the school, and he was, this is how every student is supposed to be and all that. Like a week later, they realized I'm leaving the country because my parents go and tell, well, we're leaving the country.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they bring me into the principal's office and they offered me protection. They said, if you want to stay in Cuba, La Revolución.
You were 13, 14 at the time. Were you tempted?
No. Of course not. Are you kidding?
You must have been flattered a little bit.
I was flattered a little bit that they did that. I still am. that La Revolución was willing to pay for my education and for everything.
They are two very competing narratives when we look back at the past 45 years in Cuba, the reign of Fidel Castro, 78 years old, still going strong, still speaking for 4, 5, 6 hours at the microphone when he gets the opportunity. And we'd like to get your thoughts on how those two narratives fit in with the history of this country, the United States. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour, we're talking about the legacy of Fidel Castro, his control over Cuba over the past 46 years that he's been in power. Adriana Bosch is here with me in the studio. She has a doctorate in international affairs from the Fletcher School at Tufts, and she makes documentaries. She's done them on Carter and Reagan, Ulysses S. Grant and Eisenhower. Her latest is a little bit more personal because it's about Fidel Castro. Adriana was born in Cuba and has her own thoughts and memories and connections with the man. We'd like to have you in on our conversation as we assess the different narratives about him and his country. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're taking our next call from Providence, Rhode Island. And Paul's joining us. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about the assassination attempts.
The U.S. attempts to assassinate Castro?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, this is a... It seems like a singularity in U.S. policy with a leader that we admit having tried to assassinate, and I wonder why it never comes up in news articles when Castro is at an international meeting. One would think that this would be kind of fairly remarkable. Oh, yes, and this is the guy we tried to bump off several times.
Well, you know, Operation Mongoose was a very personal operation, and it was a Kennedy operation. It came right out of Bay of Pigs and the humiliation of Bay of Pigs and Bobby Kennedy's obsession with vindicating his brother and his brother's reputation. The reason we found out about it is because there were congressional hearings, the church committee, and they came up at that time. It was a period in U.S. history, and I think, you know, that it was very wrong. And it should have never been done. And it only reinforced Castro's own claims that the United States was after Cuba. In fact, after the missile crisis and after Kennedy's death, for a long time, the United States had a policy of benign neglect toward Cuba. The embargo stayed in place. Operation Mongoose was allowed to operate. But the United States had made a commitment to the Soviet Union never to invade Cuba. So Castro was, in fact, protected from a U.S. invasion. And a lot of the claims that he was under an imminent threat by the United States of America, of an aggression by the United States of America, was an overstatement. And the one thing that was true is that he had this incredibly hair scheme plots against him happening almost on a daily basis.
I'm wondering if when we regard Castro as this leader of a small country between the USSR and the USA, we somehow tend to think of him as not really having that much to say about being caught between the two. That's part, I think, of the American narrative, that the Cuban Missile Crisis wasn't about Cuba, that the Bay of Pigs wasn't really about Cuba, that this was all part of the Cold War. Your take on that's a little bit different.
Yeah, he was caught in the missile crisis. I mean, that's when he overplayed his hand, and he learned that he was, no matter how important, still a small country facing great superpowers. And when the deal between the Soviet Union and the United States was struck and the missiles were withdrawn from Cuba, he wasn't told. He found out through the wires and through the newspapers, and this deeply offended him. And from that moment on, as the documentary says, he never again trusted the Soviet Union.
He was happy to take their cheap oil and happy to sell his sugar, but...
He kept trying to find a margin of independence from them. And the way in which he did this was by trying to create a revolutionary movement responded to him, under his leadership, and also try to find what I call in the documentary the silver bullet, something that would jump Cuba, that would just catapult Cuba out of underdevelopment and dependence. And of course, that those were usually wild schemes. Cuba is a dependent country. He could not survive without the Soviet Union, and he failed over and over again. But the objective of trying to find a measure of independence was always there. In the 1970s, he hits on something really extraordinary, which is he will now not only follow Soviet dictates in the world, he will lead the Soviet Union. And in leading the Soviet Union, he will become recognized as a leader independent from the Soviet Union and actually find his place in the sun.
And he does this. He does this by sending Cuban soldiers to Angola.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Soviets find out after the Cubans are there. We have a story that the Soviet Foreign Ministry receives a cable that says Spanish-speaking black soldiers are now in Angola, and that the Soviets had no idea that the first group of Cubans, when they arrived in civilian uniform before the large number of forces came, were there, and that the Soviets were caught by surprise as much as the Americans were caught by surprise. Subsequently, the Soviet Union gets dragged into the conflict and does supply Cuba with weapons, and he becomes really the person who's who's carrying the weight of this campaign logistically. The Cubans always lead it.
I want to come back to that, but we have a number of people who want to join us on the phone. So we're going to go next to Boston. Yvette's joining us. Hi, Yvette.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for calling. What are you thinking?
I actually wanted to go back sort of to the story that Adriana was saying before, and just I found it very similar to mine, even though I came much later, sort of at a different time. I was born in Cuba and came in 1980 during the Mariela Key West boat lift and grew up in Miami, with same sort of experiences with my parents as she had, and then went away to college at Columbia, very liberal, leftist place, and have stayed in the Northeast since then, and sort of during my adolescence really grappled with what I had learned and what other people viewed Cuba and Castro as, and also found that many Americans had a very romanticized notion of Cuba, having gone back now to visit my family and seeing the reality of the destitute and fear in which they live every day. I've come to a new realism of what the Cuba as a dictatorship is, and people in this country very much have this romanticized notion of communism and Marxism, and having read, Marx and all of these things in college, I realized the reality that's there is much different from what people would like it to be.
I'm just wondering if the what you saw when you went back, Yvette, stands as something of a big contradiction to the way that people who admire Castro would like to think the country operates.
Yeah.
Because, I know the arguments. I hear them. We've heard them on this radio program where people say, the medical system, socialized medicine, is better there than it is in much of the rest of North America. The education system is better for people there. What do you think?
Well, I think it depends on which part of the country. I think it depends on what is being, I think what is sold as and what actually occurs seems to me very different just in what I've experienced. And, I try to be objective about it. Clearly, it's my family, so it's difficult. But, you get a free education, and yet during high school you have to go to supposedly farms, and the way you give back to the community for your education, it's a very nice notion that you harvest the fields, and you're supposed to harvest the fields for...
What's the story, Adriana, of your own father having cows in the city? This is part of it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, this is in the 1960s. We had a finca on the west, on the western part of the island, and my father, in order for us to survive in the years that we stayed in Cuba, imported a couple of cows and, basically set them out to pasture on a lot right across the street from my house. And I remember people begging for a glass of milk, begging my mother.
Access to milk.
Until they were 3 years old, and then after that, not.
Uh-huh.
I think this brings up a very interesting point. It is true that in the 1960s, in the 1970s, particularly with Soviet support, the Cuban government was able to deliver on education and on health. People did go to the university. People did acquire an education. A health system was established. What happens is that after the collapse of the Soviet Union took place, there was nothing to sustain. Everyone wants a health system and an educational system, but you have to have an economy that is capable of sustaining them. And also you have to have an economy that is capable of providing work and a future for the people you've educated. And that's really ultimately the enormous, the great failure of the Cuban Revolution and Fidel Castro. You find today a population that is overly educated for the job they do, which is take care of American tourists. And that, to me, is...
less and less American tourists, more people from other countries.
Or from other countries. Well, I tell you what, the reason I use that is that I think in the future it is going to be American tourists. Yeah. And that they're going to be taken care of by engineers and by... You know, and by teachers.
So you got a medical doctor who's making the beds in the hospital,
exactly,
in the
hotels. And I find this to be a very sad circle, as a nationalist and as a Cuban, that in the end we are going to end up being a tourist country again, a country that went back to exactly the point or to someplace close to the point that of departure and the kinds of things that people really rebel against.
Let's go to Cambridge for our next call. Ramon's on the line from there. Hi, Ramon.
Hi. I'm from Adriana's generation, and I haven't seen the documentary. I'm looking forward to this attempt to bridge two
narratives.
What I think are very mutually exclusive narratives of people, you know, Cubans who've been either on the island or on the exile community. And I think for those of us who've been to both sides and tried to deal with each on its own terms, at least for me, one of the things that I take away is that the issue of the power of the United States in this relationship is just defining one. And U.S. policy has fueled and keeps fueling this gap with very, tragic consequences for families. And you can see that either with the recent measures that now prohibit families from visiting. You know, you can't visit your cousin. This is U.S. policy. Your cousin mm-hmm. or your uncle ever.
And now you can't take American dollars in.
Right. And even close, if you have a dying father, uncle, or grandfather, you would have to wait 3 years. So I think it's a situation where this incessant hostility of taking sides with the most extremist part of our community, all it does is feeds this state of national security or insecurity, which any country would go through. And basically,
now some of this, though, Ramon, comes from the Cuban-American community that wants these kinds of screws tightened on Castro's administration.
Absolutely. A sector. And I think that the thing here is, you know, this is a radicalized conflict where one side came here and the leading most, articulated elements of that, which were the ones who were on the losing side of that conflict, have been in a 40-year alliance with the most powerful country in the world. So there's this vicious circle here where this national security in Cuba, you know, facing this enormous power, just ends up justifying everything. So all challenge is potentially a subversive challenge, even if it's a mild difference. So
are you agreeing with this, Adriana?
Well, I'm agreeing with it in terms of it being true from the point of view of the Cuban of the propaganda, not, you know, to use a strong word, of the Cuban government. I think that it's exaggerated. I think it's played up. And I think it has served to disguise a lot of failures that are intrinsic to Cuba and that are not really the consequence of U.S. policy. But it is true that American hostility in any way does become a weapon in the hands of the Cuban government to talk up the idea of national insecurity. I dare bet anything that what a Bush administration today wants least is a situation in Cuba where the United States will have to intervene. And I believe the Cuban government is smart enough and Fidel is smart enough to know that. In terms of the Cuban-American community, Ramon, the Cuban-American community comes of age truly, you know, before that they're terrorists, they're engaged with the CIA, there is all this, you know, constant harassment, but they do come of age in the 1980s and become powerful as a political voice in the 1990s, particularly after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But before that, I think American policy toward Cuba is guided by Cold War concerns. It began as as a response to Castro's being perceived as a threat in the years of the Cold War. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it just simply inertia set in, and the people who were the loudest had the most influence within the U.S., within the U.S. government, and that was the exiled community.
I wanted to ask you, let's if we can go back to where we began the program, talking about Cubans' curious relationship with Fidel, their willingness to bring in a man to get rid of a dictator, and within days that man is killing people who are part of that dictatorship. What about the relationship that the Cubans in Cuba have with Castro today? I mean, it must be such a strange relationship with authority there.
Well, you know, I tell you, it's very difficult to determine the degree of popular support Fidel has. You know, there hasn't been a reliable poll or an election that could measure that. However, I think it's very easy to know that Cubans are terrified of a future without Fidel, because they've known nothing but. Fidel has been so intrinsically, so intertwined with Cuba, with the revolution, with everything in Cuba, that a future without Fidel Castro is very hard to envision. He embodies everything. He embodies every institution. He embodies every policy. And I think there is a great deal of insecurity in Cuba as to what will happen once this overwhelmingly powerful figure passes from the scene. There is a very deep relationship that is not well understood, I think, between the Cuban people and Fidel Castro. And, you know, as with everything else, it's got probably negative aspects and positive aspects. I think a lot of Cubans, despite recognizing a lot of the mistakes and a lot of the flaws, still love Fidel at some evocative, at some level of simple cariño. I mean, they've lived with this man.
A shared experience.
Yes, they've lived with this man. They owe him. And because of that, a lot of them still love him.
Well, fascinating story, and it's well told in the documentary Fidel Castro by my guest, the filmmaker Adriana Bosch. Thank you so much for coming in.
It's my nice pleasure. My pleasure.
Adriana's documentary Fidel airs later this month on PBS's American Experience. You can check the local listings to find out where you're going to see it, where you live. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugar. It's Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.